This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is our second day of shipping materials, and we're going to keep going, including to the Western Atlas, High Atlas, and the Dumnet region.
That's Yosef Ben-Meir, president of the High Atlas Foundation, regarding Morocco's earthquake, which killed thousands of people. Details coming up. Also, one of the most divisive political figures in South African history has died. And Libya has declared the city of Derna a disaster zone from devastating floods. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Using their hands, shovels, and bulldozers, rescue workers in Morocco are racing to find survivors trapped in the rubble after Friday night's earthquake. More than 2,400 were killed when the quake struck, the strongest in the North African country in more than a century. Thousands of people have lost their homes and family members as aid crews struggle to reach isolated communities. Air Saeed Mohammed survived the quake and is helping search for those still trapped. Mohammed says sometimes they find someone alive, sometimes not. They have already died, but there is hope. He has rescued 3 people here and 10 in other villages above. International search crews and supplies are flowing in to help. This man is part of the rescue team sent from Qatar. He says they have brought supplies such as tents and food. And he says they will operate from 2 locations after coordination with the local authorities. The European Union today pledged about $1.1 million in aid funds, while the United States and other countries have offered other support. However, Morocco's government has turned down aid from France and Germany. Morocco declared 3 days of mourning for those lost on Friday's earthquake as rescuers and aid teams scramble to help survivors. Yosef Ben-Meir, president of High Atlas Foundation, has made a number of trips to a mountainous area near the epicenter since the quake hit late Friday. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam this past hour that he and his crew are about to make another run from Marrakesh to the Atlas Mountains.
We're loading up trucks of food supplies, other materials for rural families in different valleys of the High Atlas. This is our second day of shipping materials, and we're going to keep going, including to the Western Atlas, High Atlas, and the Dumnet region. It's amazing how much energy is here, how much material is being moved up. So that's what I'm seeing, a lot of trucks being loaded to be shipped to the High Atlas people.
We're hearing that the roads are still terribly blocked and the military can't even get through on a lot of the roads. Are you making it through? Did you already make some shipments through?
We did. And every day everyone is able to do more. There are areas in the higher regions, higher mountain passes that are, still needing a lot of attention, but we're able to access and be able to be of service to a large number of communities who have been terribly impacted.
And when you've done this run before, since the quake hit on late Friday, what have you seen along the way?
So it's really when you get to areas of a little higher elevation where you're seeing the need. What we're seeing crumbled homes. We're seeing tents. There are traditional tents that are quite sturdy and where a lot of people can stay. We're seeing families and groups huddle together. We're seeing a lot of united activity, solidarity. When trucks arrive, it's a smooth, organized you know, relatively organized, calm process.
What's the first thing you do? Like, are you giving people food first, or what's going on?
Unloading the trucks, and they're doing it in a very organized fashion, calmly, even as there are great need. It's moving along in a very deliberate, calm, not overly excited way, but very conscientious and day and night. We've had a truck return well into the night, and that delivery was, you know, people were ready. People are always ready. And so as much as we're able to ship at any time of day, we're able to ship. There are people there to receive in a grateful, hardworking way.
Have you seen rescue crews?
Oh, yeah. We're not in the higher areas or in the areas where there are people digging for bodies, but we're seeing people clear.
That's Yosef Ben-Meir, president of the High Atlas Foundation, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Marrakesh. Authorities in eastern Libya have declared the city of Derna a disaster zone after the Mediterranean storm Danielle caused devastating floods over the weekend in different parts of the North African nation. The official death toll stands at 27, although one of the country's leaders said as many as 2,000 or more are dead. Heavy rainfall and floods have destroyed many homes and other properties in several towns in eastern Libya. The storm is expected to arrive in parts of West Egypt on Monday. One of the most divisive political figures in southern African history has died. The 95-year-old Zulu prince, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, led the Zulu nation for more than 7 decades. But as Darren Taylor reports, he leaves behind a complicated legacy.
Many South Africans consider Mangosuthu Buthelezi a hero. He led the country's largest ethnic group, the Zulu, during the height of apartheid from the mid-1970s to the early 1990s. He founded the Inkatha Freedom Party, the IFP. But millions also see him as a traitor who betrayed the struggle for racial equality by accepting a post from the white government to lead the KwaZulu homeland.
The late Prince Buthelezi was a human being. The late Prince Buthelezi was not a saint. There are people who are going to look at the negative side of what he did while he was still alive, and there are those who are going to focus on the positive side.
Professor Berki Mgomezulu, politics head at Nelson Mandela University, says Buthelezi was a man of multiple identities.
There is no way that you can put together in a short space of time the life that spans from 1928 up to 2023. But from where I'm standing, one thing I take from him is that he stood by his word. Whenever he believed in something, no matter how good or bad it was, he would carry it through. Some leaders don't have those credentials. Today they want to sing the song, tomorrow they sing that song. With Buthelezi, you got what you saw. If he was not happy with you, he didn't mean his words. He would just say that and then show it by action.
Buthelezi, who died on Saturday, always denied being an apartheid collaborator. But he acknowledged he did whatever it took to protect his fellow Zulus. In the early 1990s, as South Africa approached its first multiracial elections, journalists revealed the apartheid government had secretly funded the IFP, even supplying and training Inkatha hit squads to kill African National Congress, or ANC, members. Thousands died in what was effectively a low-level civil war. Buthelezi was unapologetic, saying his followers had every right to defend themselves against ANC aggression. Veteran journalist Cyril Madlala says Buthelezi's complexity was so deep, he'll probably remain an enigma.
We still need to take time to reflect on that and see if we can still capture the real man that Mangosuthu Buthelezi was. But one thing that we can't deny is that we could not ignore him. History can't ignore him, whether we look at it positively or negatively. He has been a reference point of South African politics for many, many years.
After apartheid ended, Buthelezi went on to serve many years as a lawmaker. In a statement, President Cyril Ramaphosa made no mention of the Zulu prince's controversial past. Instead, he praised Buthelezi as an outstanding leader who helped secure freedom in South Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's reputation as a Nobel Peace Prize winner and a democratic leader is being challenged by the latest conflict in the Amhara, Ethiopia's region's second biggest. As Ethiopia prepares to celebrate their new year this evening, he is facing a formidable challenge to his power from militias known as Fanno. Although they have no unified command structure, these militias have demonstrated their strength in recent weeks. The violence has even raised alarms internationally, with Israel evacuating its citizens and Jewish people, Falashas, from the Amhara region recently. The UN is calling for a cessation of hostilities. Our reporter in Ethiopia, Maya Msekir, is closely monitoring the crisis. In talking to me, she first starts out by outlining the root cause of the conflict.
The conflict in Ethiopia's Amhara region right now are tensions between the Ethiopian federal government and the militia in the country's second most populous region, which is Amhara region, has been going on for some time. The Amhara militia, which are more commonly known as Fanno, had fought alongside the Ethiopian government during the two-year war in Tigray. So this war came to an end last year, November, when the federal government signed a peace treaty with Tigrayan forces. At that time, there were a lot of reports coming out that despite the peace deal being a very good development, you know, representatives of the Amhara militia were not included. So it was not a very inclusive peace deal. So one important development throughout this two-year war in Tigray was that during this war, Amhara militia, again known as Fanno, had taken over this contested land from Tigrayan administration. So, you know, border areas between Tigray region and Amhara region in Ethiopia, there are some contested land. And to this day, it remains a very contentious issue. But during the war, they took over some of that land. And there were many reports coming out from Human Rights Watch, from Amnesty International, that there was a lot of ethnic cleansing going on and actually still going on to this day. So, you know, this contested land is one of the root causes of the conflict that we see today in Amhara region. During that time, like I said, they took over that land. And at the time when the peace deal was made between the Tigrayan forces and the federal government, one of the provisions in that agreement was that this area of contested land would be dealt with according to the constitution. Now, according to the constitution, that land is legally under Tigrayan administration. That happened last year in November. And so ever since then, there's been tensions, rising tensions.
So, Maya, besides holding on to this contested region in Tigray, which the Fanno militias claim historically is theirs, what other reasons does the government give to justify the war in the Amhara region right now?
In April of this year, the federal government put out an order, you know, after the war had kind of come to an end, they put out an order saying that all militia across all regions of the country, special forces need to be integrated back into the formal security structure of the country. That would be either the federal police or the military. And this did not go down well in Amhara region for many reasons. One of them being that there were a lot of complaints coming from that side, from the Amhara regional side, saying, not from the regional, but from the militia rather, that if they integrate, you know, they will be vulnerable for attacks from the Tigrayan side and as well as from Oromia region, which, you know, has another rebel faction operating in the region as well.
Have other regional forces disarmed? Is it only the Amhara Fanno that is saying, I'm not going to disarm?
So the protest happened only in Amhara region. This strong protest to this order to integrate into the formal security structure came from the Amhara region. And it showed itself in many ways. There were road blockades, and then, you know, fighting kind of broke out between formal security representatives and militia, FANNO. And then that was quickly aggravated, turned into internet shutdowns in the region. And so that's where there was an opposition to the federal government's order to integrate.
So FANNO, like you said, a couple of years ago, was aligned with the government. Now they are fighting against the government. What are the latest updates right now in the Amhara region?
So, as I said, in April of this year, the call for integration came, and then things kind of went downhill from there in terms of the security region in Amhara. In early August, the past month, there's been a state of emergency declared, and there has been sporadic fighting up until yesterday. However, federal government troops have taken over control of like major towns and cities in the region, but fighting is still ongoing in smaller towns. I've been in contact with people from different parts, especially healthcare workers, and they're still fighting. There's a lot of people injured, a lot of people still losing their lives, and it's hard to get a formal number or a very accurate figure because not all deaths occur in the hospital, and there's not full telecom services, so it's hard to get information from one part to the other as well. But this is what it's looking like right now.
That was reporter Maya Mesekir. She talked to me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Pupils in a dozen schools in Nyiragongo territory are finding it difficult to start the school year in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's because hundreds of displaced people are housed in their classrooms and they must leave each morning before classes begin. Reporter Zanem Netizaidi has details from Goma.
Every morning since school began on September 4th, Antoinette Gahizi packs up her children and takes them to the Mboga Primary School playground to make way for the school students. Attacks by militia groups have forced Gahizi and tens of thousands of other Congolese from their homes, and in Nyiragongo territory, many internally displaced people are housed in schools. She says since the start of the school year, they have been getting up early to put their kids in the schoolyard so the children can study. After class, they head back to the classroom. But when it rains, their children get wet because there is no way to get them under cover. It's been 2 years since displaced people from Ruchuru settled in Kanyaruchinya. One of them, Ushindi Rutara, is frustrated and says the government hasn't given them enough help. He says it's still a problem here in Nyiragongo because many displaced people like himself still live in camps. He says they are asking the government to provide them at least with tarpaulins so they can build huts. Authorities in Nyiragongo territory have decided to transfer some classes to other schools where displaced people aren't housed. However, the transferred students will have to start classes in the afternoon. Kisuka Babi is in charge of primary, secondary and technical education in Nyiragongo territory. He says they have 12 schools occupied by displaced people. After the meeting of the enlarged provincial committee, it was requested that these displaced people leave the classrooms so classes can be held. Soon, these displaced people will be relocated to a new site that is being built by an international organization. As for the children of the displaced families, they are still waiting for schools to be set up at the IDP reception camps so that they can attend school too. For VOA Africa, I'm Zanem Netizaidi.
Witnesses. Witnesses in Sudan's capital say at least 46 civilians were killed and more than 100 others injured during a drone airstrike on a local market in the Mayo neighborhood south of Khartoum over the weekend. A member of a group calling itself Volunteer Youth says the injured are in critical condition at Al-Bashir Hospital. Michael Atit reports from Juba.
Muhammad Abdullah, a member of the Volunteer Youth group in Mayo, says at least 46 people, including women and children, were killed and 113 others injured during an airstrike believed to have been carried out by the Sudan Armed Forces on Sunday. Abdullah told VOA that the incident scared civilians in the area, adding that the drone attack resulted into a humanitarian disaster.
There was an airstrike around 7:15 p.m., which caused panic among local civilians, including those who were far away from the spot. This market is highly populated with civilians, and the attack caused huge humanitarian disaster.
Eyewitnesses say Goro Market, known for hosting huge numbers of the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF troops, and serves as a trading center for looted goods from the neighborhoods in eastern Khartoum. Abdullah accuses the Sudan Armed Forces of carrying out the attack. He says there was poor rescue response after the attack.
People were forced to take the wounded people and carry them on donkeys and tuk-tuk because there was no ambulance available. It was a hard time for the wounded, relatives and medical volunteers at Bashir Hospital as well.
The RSF issued a statement on its Twitter account accusing the army of bombing the area. A statement issued by Brigadier General Nabil Abdullah, a spokesperson of the Sudan Armed Forces, accused what he called rebel malicious media for disseminating misleading false claims that the Sudan Armed Forces killed civilians. The military spokesperson says airstrikes are directed solely at rebel gatherings, locations, and bases recognized as legitimate military targets. Nabil says RSF is using residential neighborhoods as human shields.
The militia group is known for terrorizing civilians and forcing them to vacate the houses, either for looting purposes or the intent to use it for their military operations.
A group of Sudanese advocates, locally known as emergency lawyers, condemned the incident perpetrated by both sides in the Sudanese conflict. The group described the drone attack as inhuman actions and crimes against defenseless civilians. The United Nations reported that about 5.1 million people have been displaced inside and outside Sudan due to the conflict between the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces that erupted since April 15th. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Today, the United States marks the 22nd anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attack, which left nearly 3,000 people dead in New York, Washington, D.C., and the small town of Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
22 years ago, hatred, terror, not win.
Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley says America was momentarily shaken, but rose from the ashes of New York, the Pentagon, and Shanksville.
To show the world that we were still standing, that we could not be toppled, that terror would never destroy us.
Milley served several tours in the wars that followed, as did Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin, who told victims' families at a remembrance, as the years go by, it may seem like the world is forgetting 9/11.
But please know this. The men and women of the Department of Defense will always remember.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nabil Biagio, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.